I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
It is a joy to be publishing The Death of Vivek Ojeda. And I wondered if we could start by talking a little bit about Vivek himself. Where did he come from? How did you find him? How do your characters arrive with you? Because he's sort of luminescent, I think, in his sort of beauty and gorgeousness.
I decided that he was dead before I decided anything else. So I think I met him first as the Vivek that's beyond the grave. And I think that his personality kind of blossomed out from that because, you know, once you're transitioned out of this life, he becomes this really like peaceful kind of person. And then I kind of worked backwards from that. So you see when he's talking from spirit world, essentially, that, you know, he's very at peace, he's very gentle, and then you can see that kind of work backwards to when he's younger, and he's getting into fights a lot, and that kind of informed, I think, the progression of his personality.
Wonderful. So the very fact of his death was freeing, because I think that's probably something that might surprise both sort of readers and people who think about constructing a narrative. Yeah, saying here's a character and they're dead might seem like a limiting way to start.
No, it turned out not to be. You know, it gave me a lot of space to think about him, both in the moments that he was alive and then also who he was in his absence. Because, you know, he's so loud in the book, whether it's in the parts where he's alive or whether it's in the parts of the book after he's passed, his presence is there even in his absence.
And it's a very powerful presence because it's also in the way that I think people will find sort of incredibly accessible. It's a contested space in the way that, you know, grief and love and these ideas, that these narratives that we have about the people that we love and that become part of our sort of struggle to own them in some ways. Was that something that you were interested in exploring, that sense of the contested space of the self and how this community tries to sort of co-opt him or release him in different ways?
Yeah, because it's like, are you who you are when you're by yourself? Are you who you are when you're with your closest friends? And this idea of self is so mutable depending on which context we're talking about. Or are you the sum of everything else? If you add all those bits up together, do you get an entire self? And I think I wanted Vivek to kind of show that it could be a shifting self. You know, he wasn't more authentic in some spaces than others. He was actually one of the most, you know, authentic people in the book in terms of how he expressed himself, in terms of how fearless he was to look at himself and move through the world, even if everyone else around him was terrified. He was like, well, this is still me and I'm still going to do this and everyone will just have to get used to it.
And that sort of incredible strength, and that he's quite a constant in that way. And was that technically when you were constructing the novel, because it shifts through time, and like you say, you start with the death and then essentially the reader sort of comes to love him and then to grieve for him as the others are grieving at the opening. Like, technically, were you interested in playing with time and in the narrative and how you told it?
I think I tend to write non-linear by default. Like, I think it's really hard for me to write in the linear way. You know, when I wrote Pets, my young adult novel, I was like, oh my goodness, one narrator who's moving through time in linear chronological order. And it was so hard. So with all my like adult fiction, it always, you know, jumps around time. It always jumps around perspectives. And that's what feels, you know, intuitively right for me. With Vivek, it's two timelines that I kind of braided together. One from when he was born, moving in that order, and then one after he dies, and then they kind of just splice with each other. But through it all, I think of him as like the anchor. Like he's the point that everyone kind of gravitates to or gravitates around. And so, yeah, he's definitely a constant in that sense.
Absolutely. And another presence who I'm kind of slightly obsessed with is his grandmother, who actually also seems to me to be a very strong presence. Is that, and it's not giving anything away to say that his grandmother also dies at the beginning of the work. Is that, that those relationships, those familial relationships across time, those bonds that we have with people we, you know, that perhaps grandparents we didn't know, or that sort of spiritual connection, that's something that you were also exploring here, right? Is that?
Yeah, I think family is a huge part of that, you know, and for a lot of people, family also includes like the lineage, the ancestors, and the spiritual ties that run between all of that. And, you know, a lot of the book is about what happens if, you know, his parents don't talk about his grandmother. They don't talk to him about it. They are, you know, really traumatized by her death. And I think that's not necessarily to Vivek's benefit. Like, I think it would have been a bit easier for him if they had kind of talked about it to him. So you kind of, you see what it looks like for a child to be a little cut off from that lineage, from that concept of family, like going back over the generations.
So interesting. It makes me think something I actually wanted to ask you about, but also, yeah, when I first, and I remember where I was when I first read this novel, but in the culture that I grew up in, it's bad luck to name a child after a living relative. Like it's a thing that you mustn't do. The idea is it will hasten their death. It's absolutely, whereas it's a very English tradition that you would pass on names. So when I had my first child, my own and my husband's family thought we might, and I was like, no live names. No, that's a thing you mustn't do. It's sort of to hasten leaving. And I think, but that sense of silence, that quality of, one of the hardest things to write, I think, and you see it in really great writers and you do it so beautifully here, is it's very hard to write in articulacy, in the sense of ideas that we can't find a way through. Sort of that sense, the idea of what it is to be silent on something. Again, is that something that you're interested in the work, this idea about what you can't say as much, or what you're not able to express as much as how we do find our way through things?
Yeah, sometimes I think that, you know, with my work, I'm like, if I can write, or if we can talk around the things that can't be articulated or defined, maybe that's a form of shaping in itself. Like maybe all the talking we do around it kind of leaves a negative space in the middle, and you can kind of see the outline of the thing by that, even if you can't define that space precisely.
That's amazing. What a fantastic, absolutely. And I think that's something that Vivek's friends do too, physically. They try to create a physical space for him in which to feel comfortable. And it seems to me that that's very important to him, that the bedrooms, like single spaces, like rooms in a way that feels like a
space.
But they make it feel vast. He manages to occupy these spaces completely beyond. I mean, that they're for him, they're places of experimentation. Does that ring true, do you think?
Yeah, because I think the idea of the intimate as something that's limited is kind of what I'm pushing against there, where I'm just like, it can be intimate, it can be as simple as a bedroom, but it can be a whole world. And I think that's so much pulled from my childhood, because that's, you know, the power of imagination, so to speak, is that you can be in one little room and you can be reading books, or you can be with, you know, your best friends, or your, like in my case, it was my little sister. And that little room becomes so much more than just a little room. It becomes this, again, this vast space. And I think that's something that is really useful, especially for like young queer people to lean into, is this knowledge that we can make our own worlds and we can make our own families. And if you can get past the idea of limits in that sense, it gives you a lot more agency about how you can move through the world.
That's just, it's incredible. And I think that sort of, that mixture of the sort of profoundly sort of intimate and emotive with the deeply political, like your work always, I think, manages to speak on all these platforms simultaneously. It also, it's just really fun. They seem to enjoy, they know how to enjoy themselves. I love that. And is that also reminiscent? Are these joys that you're drawing on from your own childhood too? That sense of just...
Yeah, I really like writing like people gathered together, because then the dialogue, I think, is some of my favorite parts, because then I'm just like, oh, I get to write banter. And it's so fun. You know, they're making fun of each other. They're joking with each other. And for me, I think so much of the life of their interaction is in their language, is in how they talk to each other. And it makes the characters feel alive for me. It makes me feel like, you know, I'm eavesdropping on their little gatherings, and I'm eavesdropping on their community. And I think, yeah, I think it's one of those things where if you can kind of see that, then you have a little bit of a map into making it real as well, because I think a lot of young queer people are like super isolated, and this idea of being able to see what it looks like to have a community in a place where you may not think such a community exists, but I'm like, there's always community. It might be hidden, not out of shame or anything, but out of privacy and for protection, but it's there, and you can tap into that, and you can have this private little bubble that I think the children have with each other, where they're able to kind of flourish and be themselves and be surrounded by people who see and affirm them.
In that sense, the work is, it's conjuring. You're literally conjuring a space in which these things not only happen within the work, but then I think that's one of the most exciting things about fiction, particularly at the moment, is it is radically empathic. It allows you to take people to spaces not only that they don't know they're interested in, but also that they hadn't conceived of in that way, and that might be incredibly liberating. And so in that sense, that's sort of also playing with liminality and playing with the edge of something. You're always sort of showing that it's not binary. That space is, you can get inside it and play around in it.
Yeah, that's definitely my favorite space. I think because I live in that space. So with a lot of the work I'm doing, I'm trying to kind of shift the world over. It's like this Toni Morrison quote where she said, you know, I stand at the border, at the edge, declare at the center, and wait for the world to move over. And I was just like, oh yes, oh, this is great. Because when I started, you know, writing, I was so worried about how I would get my stories out there, or how I would survive in an industry like this. And I really wanted a map or a guide. And then I found that Toni Morrison quote and like listened to her talk about these things. And I was like, oh, I don't need a map because I'm not going anywhere. I already know where I am and I can just stay there. And so when I write my books, and it sounds simple to just like stand in one place, but it's so much more challenging because there's a lot of pressure to move and to shift your work over to make it legible for other people. So I try to move in the other direction and move deeper into that liminality and move deeper into, like, you know, this non-linear blurred space in between things where there's a lot more nuance. And I think it benefits the readers to be able to come meet me there. I'm like, I know a lot of the times, you know, it can be challenging. I'm just like, but we'll be okay. We can do it.
One of the things about Vivek, particularly the book, as well as the character, is actually, it's profoundly inclusive. Like, I would be surprised if people did find it challenging. I think it's the most sort of generous novel. You just get to be somewhere. And I think that also technically is very challenging, to make something at ease when actually, you know, a lot of the world, the publishing world, say, particularly, is so monocultural that it doesn't even see its own boundaries. It has a false sense of universality because it thinks that it's mirroring itself so frequently. That poise, that space, is that also, do you cherish it? Do you work to protect it? And is it in your work? Is it something, be able to carve out a sort of serenity? Is that something?
Yeah, it's part of the center You know, I'm like, this is the world as I experience it. This is the world as my community experiences it. We don't get to see a lot of it, you know, shown in literature. Or if you do, usually there's a sacrifice involved. It's like, well, okay, you can show this part, but like, let's tuck that part away. And I think that that's not reflective of what people's lived experiences are. I'm like, we don't get to kind of fold away parts, or it's hurtful to try and fold away parts just to make it more palatable, I think, to people who are just like, well, this is too complex. And I'm like, but people are complex, you know, and people's lives are complex and their worlds are complex. And a lot of the time there's so many layers to it. So what does it look like to write those layers and to trust the reader to be able to engage with those layers and not run from it?
It's deeply cooperative with the technology of the book, right? The book is a deeply intimate form. It's just you on the page, you on the page, and then the reader with the page. Nobody sees how you react. You can really interrogate things. It's a really exciting space. Would you read for us? Okay, it would
yes.
be so wonderful.
So I'm going to read a little bit of the Vivette chapter and a little bit of the next chapter. So chapters 4 and I think a little bit of chapter 5. So chapter 4 is narrated by Vivek. I'm not what anyone thinks I am. I never was. I didn't have the mouth to put it into words, to say what was wrong, to change the things I felt I needed to change. And every day it was difficult, walking around and knowing that people saw me one way, knowing that they were wrong, so completely wrong that the real me was invisible to them. It didn't even exist to them. So, if nobody sees you, are you still there? Chapter 5. After Vivek died, Osita went to Port Harcourt and drank until the days were sabotaged in his memory. He didn't tell anyone where he was going, and when he got there, no one cared about where or what he had come from. He was tall and immaculately dark-skinned, muscled and handsome and generous with drinks, so the oil workers he fell in with were more than happy to spend time with him. There were hotel rooms and some women, and the memory of dirty glasses stacked high and teetering before they crashed into a sink and broke. Then the warped sound of people laughing. Osita watched the glass bounce. He felt carpet against his back and tasted a vileness in his mouth, as if someone had vomited into it. A girl straddled his hips and lowered her face to his, but it blurred into nothing.
Thank you.
The idea of a poetic mystery, this idea of love as well. Were you interested in exploring different kinds of love? Because there are so many different forms of it in this book, from the maternal to the romantic. Is love as a construct something that also gets your, I'm going to say pen itching, but I imagine it's a keyboard as opposed to a pencil.
Yeah, I think it was useful to kind of see the different aspects of it. One of the reviews, I think with NPR, they pointed out that nobody in the book loved Vivek impurely. And I really loved that, this idea of that, like, everyone's love for him was like pure and well-intentioned, even when it wounded him. You know, even the things his aunts did or his parents did, like, they weren't trying to hurt him. They genuinely thought they were trying to help. And I thought that was so important, because then you get to see how love can wound, you know, how it can be well-intentioned and it can still misstep and it can still harm the person that you're trying to protect. And I hope that's, you know, I hope that's helpful for people, because a lot of the times people have a difficult time thinking that, you know, if they love someone and they have the best intentions, then it's impossible to harm the person, or that if the person says they're harmed, then now the other person is a bad person and they feel guilty and all these things. And I think sometimes it's just as simple as you can love someone and try your best and it can still wound them. And, you know, that's, I mean, it's not necessarily okay, but it's not something to run away from. It's just a fact.
Do you think this is probably just my sort of basically parental guilt? Do you think that's particularly in relation to parents?
I think so, yeah. I think it's I think it's particularly hard for parents because it's the idea of like harming their child or wounding their child is often, not in all cases, but quite often, it's so far away from what the parent's intending, you know? And I think it's really hard for them to kind of acknowledge that the wounding is still a possibility. And I wanted to write this book that really showed the fullness of everyone's love, that could show, you know, how much Vivek's mother loved him and how he still didn't feel safe with her despite everything she was doing. And she didn't realize it until it was too late for her to change things or to fix things. And also I wanted to like kind of touch on the idea of privacy and this idea that Vivek might have kept who he was private from his mother because he just didn't want to share it. Not because, because I think for a lot of readers, it was like, oh, you know, it's such a tragedy that she didn't get to see him. But then I'm like, maybe what if he didn't want her to see him? What if he just chose this separately? And what does it look like to kind of, as a parent, deal with the fact that your child might not want to include you? Not because you did anything wrong or right, but just because they're like, this is mine. And I want it to stay mine. And I want to share it with my friends. And I want to share it with this. And I don't want to share it with you. And what that can kind of feel like as well.
And so interesting. And again, sort of so empowering, these ideas about agency and about choice, as opposed to feeling that it all has to lead to a certain conclusion, which are about, again, you know, certain ideas about narrative and how it's supposed to behave and what a happy ending looks like, which again, you subvert just with absolute genius here. Faith is also really important though. I mean, these different strands of ideas about what faith looks like too, particularly in relation to, I mean, not that the younger people aren't adults, but the sort of the older generation and their ideas about, again, faith in those communities. Is that something that was really interesting that you wanted to explore directly?
I think it's part of a lot of people's makeup. And I think it's often what people turn to when they don't know what to do. You know, like with a lot of the Vivek's parents' generation, when it came to Vivek, they really didn't know what to do. And in the absence of that clarity, they turn to faith and they turn to, you know, the priests and they turn to the church and they're like, well, perhaps I can be given some insights here that I can't find in other places. And I wonder sometimes what it would have been like if they just asked Vivek or if they just, you know, talk to him about it. There's a point in the book where, you know, he begs them to stop trying to fix him because it's hurting him, and what it looks like to kind of sit with someone, even if they don't understand what you're going through yet, or you don't understand, what does it look like to sit with them in that space of not knowing instead of trying to fix it, whether it's fixing it with faith or fixing it with something else, but this kind of a moment of stillness, I think.
Beautiful. And it's something that you were saying about the writing, but I think it's also something that we all struggle with as humans. Like it's bearing and just staying with something. Particularly, I think it's sort of in this moment where we find ourselves too, talking about space and ideas about safety, there's a real desire, I think, to end the uncertainty and to move beyond, even when actually perhaps that just hasn't happened. I'm trying really hard to not use the word COVID, but it's going to happen at some point probably. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is, obviously, it's your third book, you're published around the world. Do you find that when you're talking about this work in different cultures that different preoccupations tend to pop up? Are you finding that your conversations, I mean, I guess it's early days with Vivek because he's not out yet, except for in the UK. Do you find as the work grows and you're, because I know you've been doing lots of work, both at home, well, in America and elsewhere, has the quality of the interactions changed now that people are doing things online? We were talking beforehand about how nice it is not to have to travel for events, but it makes all events more international. So are you getting a kind of different engagement?
Yeah, I think that's been my favorite part, is that it really opens it up to a lot more people, because now people can touch in from anywhere. And that's such a huge difference from, you know, how it was before. It's a lot more accessible. And it's even more accessible for me because I'm just like, oh, this takes a little less of a toll. You know, as we're talking about, I don't have to travel as much. And I always worry when it comes to the traveling that like I can't travel as much to have as much reach as I would like. And I've always consoled myself that, you know, the books have the reach that I don't have. And it's going to be exciting, I think, to see it kind of come out in different places and see what people say about it. So far, I think one of my favorite responses to the book, it pops up in like a handful of places where there's always just like one like reader who's like, okay, so is nobody going to talk about the incest? I feel like I'm really uncomfortable with this and like no one's talking about it. And I'm like, that is a very valid response because people are kind of skirting around it, which I think is also really, really interesting because I actually thought it would be more of a sticking point than it's turned out to be. And perhaps in different cultures that might come up. Like I'm curious to see when it comes out in Nigeria, whether
right.
that is flagged a bit more.
But then I think, isn't that interesting? Because one of the things, and it's going to be interesting for people in this conversation who haven't read yet, hearing you use that word, because one of the reasons that I wouldn't refer to it is because what the novel does is explode the idea of it being incest. It's like a loving relationship between two people who are close. And also I think it just feels really honest that very often when you're growing up, loads of people's first sexual experiences come with like, whether it's with cousins or friends or family or whatever, but that sense that this truth about, you do explore with the people you grow up with in different ways, whether it's your parents, best friends, kids or whatever.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to kind of like lean into, because I think that, you know, people are like, ew, cousins. And I'm just like, oh, come on. We're being a little hypocritical here, because in a lot, like in so many cultures, it's not just the exploration part, but it's also like the culture of marrying first cousins.
Yeah.
Like my grandparents are related to each other. I don't think they're first cousins, but they're definitely cousins of some sort.
Yeah.
It's how they met is because they're related to each other. So I think that when we kind of go like, ew, ick, and pretend that this is not a thing, it bothered me a little bit. And I was like, okay, well, let's pull back the carpet, because for some reason we're acting like this is a big scandalous thing when really it's far more commonplace than is talked about. And so
yeah.
I was like, well, let's look at it. And let's look at it in a way that is just where it's treated as commonplace as it is. Well, especially when, like you said, a lot of people who grow up together and, you know, you spend your holidays with the same group of people and then all of them hit puberty at the same time. And I'm just like, oh, there's definitely some experimenting that happens there.
But also it's definitely true in my experience of the UK publishing, but also it's a different scene in the US. But it is again that sense that if you have a culture that is intensely, and publishing is tends to be very middle class and white, that's not a prevailing UK experience. My experience growing up was very local, and we didn't travel, and we all went on holiday down the road to a caravan park where we all stayed together. And it was like, that was my reality. My world wasn't an industry that believes it's mirroring a world when it's mirroring a version of a world. And that's true for some people, but actually the very sense of this word for me is really problematic, universality. There's no such thing. And what it does is to exclude, because you can't see the edge of the bubble.
Exactly.
And so I was talking about this, I was tweeting at you about it, like this genuinely, there's such a conversation between you and the work and Anna Burns' book, Milkman, and publishing didn't really understand that book, but the world did, because this experience she was writing to happens to millions and millions of people. It just doesn't happen to very many people in publishing, who then essentially kept trying to like mow the lawn with a toaster. They kept saying it's not a very good mower, and you're like, well, no, it wouldn't be.
Oh, I am completely stealing that analogy. That is brilliant.
But it's the truth, right? Like the world gets it, the industry gets in the way, but readers completely understand.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. and they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
And here's a great question from Daniel. Daniel just wanted to ask how different the process of writing this book felt with Freshwater and Pet. You know, it's the third book. Was it a different process?
So it's the third book published, but it's actually the second book I wrote. So I wrote it the year after I finished writing Freshwater. And I tried a different technique while writing it. It was very much based on word count. I was like, I will write, 2,500 words a day, and I will write them in 500 word chunks, and I will write 5 days a week. And it was not particularly fun, but it taught me a lot about how to write even when I don't feel like writing. And that was really useful. So it took me about 4 months to get through like the rough draft, which I wasn't allowed to read back anything I had written before. And then I reached the end and I looked over the whole thing and I was like, oh, this is a disaster. And then it took me another 2 months to edit it and kind of clean it up. And I was doing nothing else in that time. You know, I would just wake up, go to my desk, and for 6 months, that's all I did. And I got stuck in the middle. So I wrote the ending and then came back and filled out the middle. Because sometimes I think the middle of the books is always really, really hard for me. And yeah, I experimented with different ways. And so it was really useful because it taught me that the way I had written Freshwater was very specific to Freshwater. And the way I wrote Vivek was very specific to Vivek. And then when I wrote Pets, I was on a much tighter deadline. And that was, I think I wrote Pets in like 2 months, which was so stressful, would not recommend, definitely not doing that again. And I was also moving halfway through writing it to a new place, so it was a bit chaotic. And yeah, now I've reached a point where I'm like, okay, each book kind of likes something different or wants something different, and with each one I figure out what it is in the process of writing it.
So I was going to ask if there's a time of day, but no, you're intensely within that book for the time period that you're writing it. Yeah. It's one world and then you leave it and move on.
Yeah. So even if I'm not in front of the computer, I could be, taking a shower and thinking about plots, or that moment right before you fall asleep where you're kind of dozing off. And then I'm just like, oh, this is a great time to figure out this plot thing. And I start daydreaming about it. And it helps to really just be immersed in it. So even when I'm not typing it out, I'm still constructing the world in my head.
It's so interesting hearing writers talk about that sort of literary compost, like when the stuff is just mulching. That compost thing when you're totally not married, deeply fruitful. And in that way, are works, do you sometimes have to tell a work sort of to wait? Do things start trying? I know some writers find that new ideas are bubbling up and you have to sort of suppress them because you need to do what you're doing.
All the time. I think I have maybe like 17 books on my list, and I've written 7 of them, so I have about 10 to go. And it's very upsetting because I would really love to skip, but they're all in a queue, so I'm like, oh crap, I have to write this one first, and I'm on deadline for this one. And then I keep thinking I'm going to move to the next one, and then a new book idea comes up. A lot of them come from dreams. Interestingly, I can lucid dream. So I have like all these dreams that are like epic fantasy stories with magic. And I'm just like, I really want to write fantasy, but I have a couple more things in literary fiction to get through first. That's basically like my retirement writing, where I'm just like, I just churn out fantasy novels. That's all I do now.
I was going to say, once you end up down that route, that's like a 30 book. I was going to say cul-de-sac, but it wouldn't be. But yeah, that's a lot of, once you're in a world building place, that's a serious time. Wow.
Yeah, it's intense. And sometimes it makes me sad because I really want to read all the books, and then publishing is like so slow that, I'm working on, like, with Vivek, I finished writing it in 2016. And so on my like personal schedule, I'm about 4 books ahead, but they haven't come out yet.
And that's exponentially growing because you're still incredibly, you're delivering books and publishing isn't catching up with your speed. We're still there, like
backlog.
I feel like whenever I talk to people who are writing and want to get published, the shock of like publishing is ludicrous. I know why it's so slow, and I think sometimes it's a good thing, but it can be very shocking when someone's delivered to think, hang on a minute, what do you mean it's going to be in 18 months time? That's,
I think it's especially shocking with the first book, where you're like, how will I survive the 18 months? And then I deal with it by, you know, writing a lot of other books. Yeah. And then next thing you know, the 18 months is a year, and then it's 6 months away, and then it's like, oh, your book's coming out next week.
But I think, and particularly with your work, with it, which has such, it's so generous and it's so intense, that the, I feel like the that period of time is very necessary as a period of letting go for an author, as the work drifts away from them, as readers become very attached to it. Because I think if you're still very attached to it, the publishing process can be more painful. And so actually something about the time is really important as a process of letting go and letting it be ready. You know, it's sort of part of the gestation in a way, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's incredibly useful, because the, like, my relationship to a book at the start of, you know, the editing process versus what it is by the time it's publication day, it's such a gap between that. And yeah. I'm grateful for that gap, because it also allows me to talk about the book as a work, and to do that with kind of more, to do more justice to the work without being as wrapped up in it.
Yeah, it starts to occupy a separate space. And also you have to be a tiny bit sick of it, I think. You have to be ready for it to be somebody else's concern. That means you're ready for it to go.
By the time you get there, you're just like, here, take this book child of mine and do with it what you will. Have fun.
Very healthy. Now, I'm just reading Jonathan Morton, who says, if you could speak a little bit about how you maintained that space in your text for us to sit with otherness. And particularly, I'm thinking of those responses to Freshwater that wanted to label it magical realism rather than allowing it just to be real. Was there pushback from editors? How did you find the confidence to stick to your guns? And were there texts you read from other writers that helped with that confidence?
So I think for me, the main thing is that for me, it's not otherness, because it's my center. So I'm just like, oh, so this is where I'm coming from. And I think one of the hardest things of moving forward in publishing, or really when I just started publishing, was realizing that it was otherness for other people. And I was like, oh, that's fascinating. And so I pretty much just do the thing of, I don't move. I'm just like, this is the center that I'm at. It doesn't have to be legible to everyone, but it is legible to the people that I am writing for. And, you know, there's an interview I read with this Indigenous writer, Leanne, I cannot pronounce the middle name, it's very long, Simpson, but she was talking about how, you know, she doesn't write for white people. She did an interview with Beyond Brand that was wonderful. And so she was saying that she doesn't write for white people. And, you know, when she talks to editors or people about that perspective, and they're like, you know, well, would you want, you know, white people to kind of be included in it? And she's like, but here's the thing. She's like, white people are very welcome to read my work. But she's like, I think it's really important that they read work that does not center them. And so that's really reading that interview with what she did with Dion Brand was really useful for me, because it gave so much language to this idea of like, yes, I am centered in my world and I'm talking to my readers. And it's really important for people on the outside, who to us, they are the other. It's important for them to kind of sit with that and be like, well, what does it mean when I've gone through my whole life thinking that I'm the default? And then I meet a work like this that's like, actually, you're not the default, you are other to us. And I think a lot of the like gut response people have is to be like, no, I'm not other, you are other. And since you are other, you should explain it to me. And it's like, no, like, it's important to kind of be in that space and understand that, you know, something might not be directed from you. And I think there's, for me, honestly, yeah, there has been pushback, not so much interestingly from editors with the books I've done, but it usually comes around marketing. like usually it kicks in when we get to like the marketing phase of it, because now it's not even about the work. It's about the fact that they're trying to sell a product. And yeah. And I'm there, you know, like with Freshwater being like, I understand that if we said that this was a book about mental illness, that it would sell differently. However, no. and pushing back against that. And I think that's really where, you know, a lot of people can hold a lot of beliefs. And I mean, people in the publishing industry as well, they can hold a lot of beliefs about stuff until it like butts heads with capitalism, until it becomes yeah. about the business and the bottom line and how much the publishing house is supposed to make. And that's really the test of, okay, well, are you actually going to stand behind your convictions, even if you think it's going to cost you money? And I think that fear of like, oh, we're going to lose money if we do it this way, really like hinders a lot of it, because then I'm like, well, you'd never know because you didn't try. You know, you didn't try yeah. to see what it was like to market this book to people that you consider other, because you were like, well, yeah. they're other, they're on the outside, they're not going to buy it. And I'm just like, well, decenter yourself, you know. And I think that's yeah. like one thing that my work is pretty consistent about, is that it challenges a lot of people to decenter themselves. And I think that's important work for readers to be doing.
And I think that also you should be charging consultancy fees, because essentially it's what publishing has to learn.
I really should, honestly.
Yeah, this is something, you know, that's coming up a great deal in debates, which is, you know, that having to educate on top of everything else, having to make people understand the choices that they're making. There's a really fantastic novel called Jim Patrol on the Purple Line by a young Indian novelist, and I talked at length with her about this idea that this was before it was with a particular publisher, so that I'm not saying that her publisher did this, but I was like, yeah. but one of the things you have to be really careful about is that you are trying to unpack a sort of very commonplace English idea about Indianness that we used to sell, you know, sort of like tinkly bells and elephants. Like, that's the very thing this work is unpicking and challenging. You have to be really aware when you go into these conversations that you can't have the marketing sit at odds with the very work the novel is trying to do. It can't, on the one hand, use the tropes that you're trying to unpick to get people to sort of pay attention to the work. If the world is ready for some actual challenge, for some actual change, for some difference from, or indeed, actually, exactly what you say, which is neither challenge or change, but just something that they recognize themselves in. It is all about where you sit, isn't it? So I agree with you wholeheartedly.
I put in the link to the interview with Dion Brand, because I think it's a wonderful read. Highly recommend you all click on it and read it. It really changed. There was a text that helped me kind of like hold my place. It would absolutely be this interview, which I only found out about like a week or two ago, and it's from 2018. But it was like a fundamental kind of shift for me in just understanding that I could like push back against publishing. You know, like I could push back against like my editors if need be. I could push back against publicity and marketing. And I could say, hey, I understand why you're doing things, because really the reason is capitalism most of the time. It's like, I understand that like white supremacy and capitalism are entrenched together in this particular way. And when I'm making work that pushes it back against both of these things, it's like, it creates a kind of like this little paradox for them of, well, what do we do, you know? And I'm like, well, I'm gonna push you to do the difficult thing. And it is honestly like really, like I will admit that it has been very difficult for me, because I love making the work. I hate educating. It feels, yeah. it takes so much emotional energy from me. And it feels so upsetting, because I'm like, white authors don't have to go through this. It got to the point where I think earlier this year, I was talking to my therapist about it. And I was just like, if there's one thing that would make me stop writing books, it would actually be this. It's not the books itself, but the fight to protect them when they go out into the world, the fight against like people who are in, you know, gatekeeping positions of power within the publishing industry, who are writing like, you know, anonymous reviews for the books, and who are presenting themselves as objective. when they're not, and saying, well, my objective read of this book is the true read of the book. And I get very sensitive about it when it's pre-publication reviews, because then I'm like, the reader doesn't have access to the book to make their own decisions. When a book hasn't come out yet and someone's doing a review and they're talking about, you know, well, the book is this and the book is that, you are expecting the readers to trust that you are giving a fair and unbiased, you know, account of the book. And often it's not fair and it's not unbiased. There's a lot of, like, you know, racism that they're not aware of that's coming through. There's a lot of ignorance that's coming through. And I think people are really afraid, especially when they're in gatekeeping positions in the industry. I think people are really afraid to say, I am not qualified to write on this book. Yeah. I am not qualified to address this work. I'm not qualified to critique this work because I don't even understand it. And I will do it a disservice by trying to critique it from that point of view. And so then I have to, like, engage and, like, push back and correct things and all of that. And it just feels so, like, violent and exhausting, because I'm like, I just want to make work. Like, I just want to, like, be an artist and not do all this extra work. And I was like, it gets so stressful with each book. And I'm like, I have so many books coming forward that I'm like, how many more times, just realistically and sustainably, am I going to be able to do this before it gets to the point where I'm like, you know what, it's not even worth it to put out a book anymore. Because I don't think that a lot of people in the industry understand how much of a toll it takes on the authors, and how much it, like, beats our spirits down to have to protect our work and to fight for our work, and then be risked as seeing as, you know, the angry Black author, or, like, the difficult one, or this and that. Like, there's so many layers to it. And then by the time you get to a certain point where, I think I've reached that point now where I think, you know, my agents have watched me for the past, you know, 5 years go from being, like, a really scared baby writer to now I'm just like, oh, that's bullshit. And we're not doing that. And they've been so supportive of that. And I'm really grateful for it, because I couldn't do it alone at all. But I'm aware that, like, I know what books I have coming out. And I already know that there's going to be a lot of tension around the centers that I keep claiming over and over again. And part of me has just accepted that, you know what? If it gets to the point where people are just like, oh, this author is super difficult and super particular and all these things, I'm like, so be it. Because at the end of the day, my job is just to make sure that the books get out. It's just to make sure that they're published so that the readers can find them. And if I have to fight tooth and nail, you know, with the help of my brilliant agents to get it done, then I will. But I really had to let go of this idea of being liked. Because I was like, actually, when you're working in, I'm sorry, I know I'm going on like this whole rant, when you're working in an industry that is so, like, centered in whiteness and centered in capitalism, pushing against it is going to upset people. It is going to piss them off. Yeah. It's going to upset people, from the people publishing to the media that's covering it. Like, it's just going to upset a whole bunch of people. And I think I'm just like, okay, so I know what I need to do to kind of stay true to the work and to protect it so that it can reach the readers in the form that I intended. And what I have to focus on in the next couple of years is basically protective measures. How can I protect myself as I'm protecting the work? And how can I do this without it, you know, taking so much of a toll on me, which is scary.
It's scary and exhausting, and it has to be, that you have to be able to expect more from your publishers in the industry. And one of the reasons that the liberal media finds this so difficult is because the very idea of itself as being liberal means it finds it very difficult to be honest about its own failings. You know, people like to think of themselves as being open-minded. The hardest people to show that they are closed-minded are the people who don't like to think of themselves in that category, because they believe themselves to already be somehow beyond it. And those hard truths for the industry has to be, if anything is to change, where it begins genuinely look at itself, behave differently, and to really protect and enshrine those rights, because it's not the author's job. You know, it is our job to celebrate and protect and to keep the work, you know, keep the energy for the work. And I think that that sort of heartfelt, that level of investment, that level of that you are paradigm shifting, right? And you, that is an exhausting thing to try and do. And it has to be that just in the same way that you're talking about your agents, but that the publishing world itself match, at the very least, matches that energy, that commitment, that rigor, that care, and stops trying, you know, and the thing I was saying earlier about, you know, whether it's mowing with a toaster, but stops thinking that it has an understanding when it doesn't, and that it constantly, not only do you not need a map, it doesn't have a map. And if it keeps trying to map things, you know, old-fashioned maps use churches, villages are always mapped by churches, that won't continue. That, you know, the topography of our culture has to change, and we have to stop trying to fix things on to a topography that is outmoded. Thank you so much, Kweke.
Lisa, this was delightful. Thank you to everyone who came. Louisa and I will have more books for you in the years to come.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.